Now, Alex Jennings reads from Explorers of the Nile, The Triumph and Tragedy of a Great Victorian Adventure by Tim Jeale. John Speke's discovery of Lake Victoria in East Africa led to a bitter feud with his ex-colleague Sir Richard Burton, and before Speke's reputation could be established, he died in a shooting accident aged 37. But prior to his return to England, he'd encountered another explorer, Samuel Baker. Since Speke had been forced home before he could explore an important lake northwest of Lake Victoria, he had suggested to Baker that he should make the journey.
Eighteen months before Speke's death, in March 1863, Samuel Baker and his remarkable mistress, Florence, in her loosely cut breeches and knee-length gaiters, left Gondokoro on the journey to find the lake known as Luta Nzige, as Speke had suggested. Baker had purchased his Florence, as he called her, 2 years earlier at an auction of white slaves in Bulgaria. Baker had soon fallen in love with her, not that this was suspected by any of his four teenage daughters, who had been cared for in England after their mother's premature death by an unmarried sister. Baker recruited 17 porters, a wholly inadequate number. To compensate, he took 24 donkeys as well as several camels and horses. He persuaded a Syrian ivory and slave trader, Ibrahim, to join forces with him, promising first not to interfere with Ibrahim's slave raids. Unfortunately, Ibrahim's trading activities took him away from the Nile, and with murder commonplace in the area, there was no possibility that Baker and Florence could travel in safety away from the caravan. When Ibrahim decided to make a series of raids lasting several months in a particular area, Baker and Florence were obliged to await his pleasure. Characteristically, they made the best of it, setting up home together in a mud hut, keeping hens, growing lettuces, onions and yams in their garden, and trying their hand at making wine and pombe. 9 months later, they were still 200 miles from their objective and frequently in danger, despite Ibrahim's presence, indeed partly because of it. Baker and Florence were in the village of the chief of the Obo when they fell dangerously ill with malaria. This time, neither had the strength to help the other. They could not keep down water and were delirious. On finding them lying helpless, Kachiba, the old chief, filled his mouth with water and squirted it about, including over the sick pair, and left, confidently predicting that they would get better. Given how many European traders had died in these latitudes, his optimism was surprising, but he turned out to be right. When the rains came, Baker welcomed them since they brought the temperature down to below 100 degrees Fahrenheit. "How delightful to be cool in the centre of Africa. I was charmingly wet. It was no longer the tropics. The climate was that of old England restored to me." But soon all his stores were covered in mildew, and even with constant fires burning, it was impossible to dry out his possessions. By July, he and Florence had suffered many more attacks of fever, and their stock of quinine had been reduced to a few grains. Their horses and donkeys were all dead. Even when Baker invested in 3 oxen, beef, steak, and suet, he and Florence found they lacked the strength to mount them. But at last, he managed to persuade Ibrahim to come with him to Bunyoro. On the 4th of January 1864, Florence and Baker swallowed the last grains of quinine in their medicine chest and prepared to head south the following day. After an hour or so of travelling, Baker's ox bolted, obliging him to walk 18 miles on the first day. As they struggled through 10-foot-high grass, they found themselves stumbling into deep swamps between undulations in the land. The march became exhausting for man and beast. Finally, they reached a broad river, flowing from east to west, and from Speke's notes, they assumed it must be the Nile. After lengthy discussions, the headman of the district reluctantly agreed to let Baker and Florence cross. Baker and Florence slept on the ground on straw under a Scotch plaid, having dined on ripe plantains, washed down with plantain wine that tasted like thin cider. Next day, nobody would tell them a word about the lake, although they asked numerous people. Not that the natives were hostile. Indeed, the sight of Florence combing her long blonde hair created as great a stir, in Baker's phrase, as a gorilla would have done appearing on a London street. At the end of a wearisome week of waiting, some men arrived from the local king, Camrazi, and agreed that Baker and all his men could leave the following day. Florence fell ill on the first day of the march, and for a week Baker feared she would die. Baker was so weak that he had had to be held upright on his ox's back by two men, and even then he fell off and had to rest under a tree for 5 hours. On the 10th of February, they at last arrived at Chaguzi, and a man called Mgambi, whom Baker took to be Camrazi, came to see him. Later, he was carried to the royal hut, where he presented the supposed king with some presents, including a large Persian carpet, a pair of red Turkish shoes, some necklaces, and a double-barreled gun, before asking permission to travel to the lake. Baker was finally given permission to leave on the 23rd, but at the last moment, just as the oxen were being saddled, Mgambi said casually, "I will send you to the lake, but you must leave your wife with me." In his account, the only one there is, Baker thrust the muzzle of his revolver against Mgambi's chest and said he would shoot him dead if the insult was repeated. Mgambi was astonished by all the fuss. He said he would have been perfectly happy to have offered Baker one of his wives. By way of compensation, he ordered all the bystanders to act as carriers for Baker, and in addition provided an escort of 300 men. 4 days later, they had to cross the Kafu River, which was covered over with thickly matted aquatic plants, forming a bridge of sorts. To ride oxen on this trembling and uncertain surface was impossible, so even the desperately ill Florence had to walk. Baker urged her to follow him, treading exactly where he had placed his feet. Looking back, when less than halfway across, he was horrified to see her standing in one spot and sinking gradually through the weeds, while her face was distorted and perfectly purple. Baker and about 10 men dragged her like a corpse through the yielding vegetation. I laid her under a tree and bathed her head and face with water. But she lay perfectly insensible, her eyes opened but fixed. It was in vain that I rubbed her heart and the black women rubbed her feet. She was carried mournfully forward as a corpse. Next day they pressed on, but had to stop when Florence became delirious. In the morning they started again, and in the evening, after a long day's march, she had violent convulsions and it seemed all but over. He lay down on a plaid beside her, while outside his men began to dig her grave. Yet at first light, when she opened her eyes, they were calm and clear. During the following week, Florence slowly recovered. On the 14th of March, on a clear day, they climbed out of a valley and toiled to the top of a hill. Below them was the lake.
The glory of our prize burst suddenly upon me. There, like a sea of quicksilver, lay far beneath the grand expanse of water. A boundless sea horizon on the south and southwest, glittering in the noonday sun. It is impossible to describe the triumph of that moment. England had won the source of the Nile.
Baker decided to name his lake Albert Nyanza, after Queen Victoria's late lamented consort. He did not attempt to force circumnavigation, partly because of Florence's ill health. After a week of recurrent fever, enough of his men had recovered to embark the entire party in 2 canoes and paddle northwards along the eastern shore to try and find the river at the top of the lake, linking it to the Nile. But their men paddled instead into the river connecting their lake with Lake Victoria. During their 18-mile voyage upstream, Baker thought he might die. He lost consciousness, and as darkness fell, was carried on a litter to the nearest village. Next morning, both were too weak to walk and were carried to their dugout, where they lay like logs while the canoes continued their voyage. On the third morning, they heard a sound like distant thunder. As the men paddled against the flow, the water became spume-flecked and the noise of the waterfall grew louder. At the next bend in the river, an unforgettable sight greeted them. The whole river was funneled into a rocky cleft and burst from it as if from a ruptured water main to cascade and tumble down the rock face for 120 feet in a foaming mass of snow-white roaring water. As his men were paddling away from this natural marvel, Baker, ever aware of his own self-interest, decided to name it the Murchison Falls, after the man at the Royal Geographical Society who could do more than any other for his exploring career. While Baker managed to toil up the cliff path that brought them to the track above the falls, Florence had to be carried. They now faced 7-foot-high grass and waterlogged country. It was raining, and they were wet and cold. Without riding oxen and quinine, their chances of survival looked slim. Sleeping on straw in a succession of waterlogged huts, they grew weaker and could no longer move from the positions in which they'd been deposited. When Camrazi, the king of Bunyoro, sent a courtier with the proposition that Baker and his men should join him in attacking his enemies, Baker told the king's emissary that if Camrazi wanted an alliance, he would have to deal face to face with him and send 50 men at once to transport him and his wife to the royal camp. The men duly arrived next day, and after 3 days' travel, the whole party arrived at Camrazi's camp. To make an impression, Baker exchanged the rags he was wearing for a full-dress Highland suit with all the accessories, kilt, sporran, and Glengarry bonnet. In this astonishing outfit, he was carried by 10 of his men through curious crowds to Camrazi's hut. From the time of their meeting, Camrazi gave Baker an ox every week, plenty of flour, and a cow that produced copious milk. So though the lovers could not leave and suffered attacks of fever almost daily, they began to grow stronger on their new diet. Baker was eventually allowed to leave Bunyoro for home in November 1864, 10 months after his arrival, escorted by Ibrahim and his caravan. Baker's great dilemma now was whether or not he should take Florence back to Britain with him. But by the time he reached Alexandria, Baker had finally decided that he would not be able to endure life without her. So he sent a telegram to his brother, asking him to arrange a quiet marriage in London. On the day of their wedding, Baker and Florence dined with Sir Roderick Murchison, and found him purring with satisfaction at being immortalized by having one of Africa's most spectacular waterfalls named after him. On the 13th of November, Baker was formally welcomed home at a meeting at the RGS's Burlington House headquarters, and awarded the Society's gold medal. The knighthood, which Murchison had failed to conjure up for John Speke, followed shortly. With Speke dead, and Burton and Grant no longer involved with exploration, Murchison needed someone else to galvanize the public. Baker's gift as a public speaker and raconteur blinded all but a few to his shortcomings as a geographer and explorer. So the man who owed everything to Speke was perfectly happy to pose as a greater explorer than his dead friend. Had Speke been alive, Baker would not have dared make such claims for his lake. If Speke had not generously directed Baker to Lake Albert when he himself was forced to return home, nobody would have heard of the man who was now the toast of the town.
Alex Jennings reading from Explorers of the Nile, The Triumph and Tragedy of a Great Victorian Adventure by Tim Jeale. It's abridged by Libby Spurrier, produced by Joanna Green, and is a peer production for the BBC. Tomorrow, David Livingstone, I presume, aims to solve the mystery of the Nile's source once and for all.
BBC Radio 4 Extra.
It's 3 o'clock. Good afternoon, 4 Extra-ers. Cathy Clugston here today. Simon Templar uncovers a fascist conspiracy to seize power in France next, as you do. Mel Gedroyge examines our love of nursery rhymes in today's 4 o'clock show. And later tonight, a young boy uses rhymes and simple poems to cope with his difficult home life and his dreams of a glittering career. Benjamin Zephaniah's Listen to Your Parents is at 9:15. So let's get back on the road again with the saint and his companion. A night on the town is about to turn sinister when something unexpected comes across the airwaves.
The Saint Plays with Fire by Leslie Charteris, dramatised by Neville Teller, with Paul Rees as the saint Kim Thompson as Patricia Holm and Fiona Fullerton as Lady Valerie.
Three cheers for our licensing clause.
I suppose you like being packed off to bed when the clock strikes 11.
But darling Patricia, just think. If it weren't for our professional nannies, we'd still be swilling inferior champagne and being deafened by saxophones in that revolting roadhouse.
If only.
Instead of reveling in the magnificent English countryside. You are reveling in the magnificent English countryside, aren't you?
I can't see any magnificent English countryside. It's pitch black out there.
Well, revel in the magnificent English country road, then. You can see that.
Oh, for some saxophones.
Miss Holm wants saxophones. Saxophones Miss Holm shall have.
And toss them like vermin. Destroy them like rats who would carry their plague germs throughout our fair land. The blood of a million Frenchmen dead on the field of glory cries out to you! Show yourselves worthy of their sacrifice. Rise up and arm yourselves against this peril that threatens you from within. Sons of France, I call you to arms.
For heaven's sake, Simon, switch it off.
No, listen to it, Pat. It's the sound of a world gone mad. I've heard this sort of thing before. One night I was fiddling with the radio and caught some Nazi jamboree.